Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 9 to chapter 20, to verse 20 in the chapter. Let us hear the word of God. Then I, and that's Nehemiah, came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I rose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the wall by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and returned to the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were doing the work. Then I said to them, "You've seen the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also the words of the king had spoken to me. And they said, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" And I replied to them, "That the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will rise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." For nearly any activity, any endeavor to be successful, it takes good leadership. I remember a number of years ago when Mike Krzyzewski took a time off from coaching the Duke team, the basketball team. They were perennial top 10 team. But that year, when he wasn't there to coach them, most of the season, they were below 500. He made that much difference. They had all the talent, but they didn't have the leadership they needed to do that. And there are certain restaurants that have same size, same menu, same prices, same design. One looks like another. But if you go to the corporate headquarters, certain one of those restaurants will be leading the way. They'll be always in the top 10. And then there'll be those that are underperforming, is the word that they'll use. And there may be some other factors of where they're located, but probably the most important factor is who their leadership is, who's guiding that particular restaurant. Because one will have good leadership, they'll consistently hire good workers, will train them well, will encourage them, will provide a good working environment where the workers want to come in and work. And the ones that are underperforming won't have those things. They'll have an environment of bickering and complaining, of employees goofing off and poor planning. And we could look at a bunch of areas, whether it be politics, and you think of World War II, how Winston Churchill was the right man to rally the nation in the darkest hour. Or we could think in terms of family, and Rachel's been reading a book about a woman's autobiography, and that family was the epitome of poor leadership. The father was an alcoholic, and whatever money came in their hands, he used to buy tobacco and to drink. And so they were constantly hungry, constantly in poor position. And the mother was sort of an idealist that treated all of us as a great adventure. And not to worry about it. The same thing is true in the church. The type of leadership is crucial. And especially when it comes to church leadership, the key is faith. The leadership in the church must exercise faith. You can think about King Saul. You know, he's physically very imposing. The people naturally followed him, naturally wanted him to be their king, to be their leader. But at a crucial time, he failed. And the contrast was David, who was not as physically impressive as King Saul was, who couldn't even carry Saul's armor out to battle, but had great faith. And thus it was David who went out to fight Goliath, and David who defeated Goliath, and not Saul. Well, another man that we can learn from who had great faith is Nehemiah. He was really a great leader of God's people who achieved great success. And it was because of his leadership. It was because of his faith. Last week we looked and saw that he had a bold faith. A bold faith that was willing to risk everything. His position, his life, for God, the sake of God. Who made great requests of the king. Things that might seem a little impertinent. Yet he was able to do that. And then he undertook a great task of rebuilding the wall. And today we'll look at him again and see his faith. And besides this bold faith, we'll notice three more things about his faith. First, it was a realistic faith. Second, it was an infectious faith. And third, it was a determined faith. And so the first thing that we see about Nehemiah's bold faith is that it was a realistic faith. And how do we see that? Well, first, after he makes this journey from Susa to Jerusalem, and we don't know the route. If we took the short route through the desert, it would have taken 2 months to get there, and it would have been a very rugged trip. If you'd taken the longer route up and over, it would have taken 4 months. And it still would have been a fairly strenuous trip. It isn't like today, where we could just hop in the car and go hundreds of miles. No, it's more like in the history of our nation, when they took the wagon trains. You wanted to get to the gold strike in California, we had to set out from St. Louis and travel arduously. You know, you'd go through the rivers and the mountains and have hostile Indians attacking and all the rest. And so what's the first thing he does when he gets to Jerusalem? Well, in verse 11, he stays there 3 days. He's resting those 3 days before he gets up and looks around. He realizes he needs to recuperate from his trip. And realistic faith realizes that fatigue is real. And it can impair your judgment. It's not a good idea to make important decisions when you're tired. It's a reminder to us that physical tiredness, exhaustion, can rob people of their proper thinking. It frays our emotions. It makes life seem burdensome. It distorts our perspective. So the decisions that result are not always right. I think of young woman in college. You know, she wanted to be more spiritual. She was feeling like she wasn't making any progress in her spiritual life. And you sit down and talk to her, what are you doing? Well, she talked about, well, on Monday night I have this prayer meeting. On Tuesday night I have a Bible study. On Wednesday night I'm going out witnessing to people. On Thursday nights another Bible study. On Friday's large group meeting. Saturday, I get up at 7 and spend 4 hours of prayer. And then, and you ask, well, how much sleep are you getting? Well, 2, maybe 3 hours a night. Well, if you want to be more spiritual, get more sleep. Because that was really her fundamental problem, is she was so exhausted, overwhelmed with her studies and all the Christian activities, that she couldn't finish straight. She hadn't learned to prioritize and to consider what's most important. What she really needed was more sleep. We also see Nehemiah isn't hasty in presenting his ideas. Although he has a vision of what's to be done, he doesn't speak out hastily. So in verse 12b, he says, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. Now, part of the reason, maybe he's already encountered, you look back at verse 10, some opposition that Sanballat and Tobiah are displeased that he's there. They've seen the letters of reference that he has from the king and knows what his purpose is, and they're not happy. But he doesn't even speak to his colleagues. He doesn't speak to the Jews right off about what he's going to do. Oftentimes, a good idea gets blasted out of the water ahead of time because it's presented too early. Before it's fully developed, before the people are ready for it, it can undermine what you're trying to do. And so he goes out. He knows he has to have more understanding of the situation. You need to see the walls and exactly what they're like and the gates. And so he goes at night when it won't attract attention. He only has one animal, so there won't be much suspicion raised. And sees what the exact situation is. He knows. He can answer the questions. He can be realistic in what he calls upon the people to do because he knows the facts. He knows the details. And true faith involves seeing the problems, anticipating them, but turning to God for the solutions. And some Christians are very visionary in their thinking, but they ignore the problems, they ignore the difficulties, they really ignore the facts, they just want to get ahead with it. They'll pray for revival, they pray for it fervently. They don't do anything to bring it about. They don't understand that God uses means. And you need to be part of the solution. And numerous times I've heard people say, well, this congregation isn't, whatever it is, friendly enough or whatever. Well, why aren't you part of the solution? We don't reach out enough. Well, what are you doing to reach out to people? No person to expect God to answer prayer that they're not willing to be a part of that answer. And like Nehemiah, before we start building a work for God, we need to be looking at what are the obstacles. What must be fixed? I mean, let's deal with the reality. In this congregation, we can look at, you know, how's the worship? How's the preaching? Does it meet the needs of God's people? How's the singing? Is it all that it should be? How's our prayer life? Do we have that proper focus? Do we have intensity? Do we desire to see God bless us? How's our outreach? Do people know we're here? Is it vital? Is it encouraging other people to come, to using the gospel and sharing the gospel with others? too often a church will kind of muddle along, just content with the status quo, not wanting to look at, you know, what are the true situations? Are there some ruins that we need to repair? Are there some issues in the church that we need to deal with? That can also be true in our personal lives. Are we realistic about ourselves? It begins as, are we trusting in Jesus Christ? Are we faithful reading our Bible? Are we engaging in honest and believing prayer? Do we have joy in worship? Are we playing around with temptation? Or do we seem to be making the same spiritual mistakes time and again? Our thoughts are rarely on how do I glorify God in this situation. Nehemiah had a very realistic faith that he looked at the situation, looked at the problems, looked at the obstacles, and then proceeded. The second thing that we can see is, besides having that realistic faith, he also had an infectious faith. This is especially highlighted as we look at the end of verse 18. What was the response of the people to the faith that Nehemiah showed? They said to him, "Let us rise up and build." And so they strengthened their hands for the good work. Realize how remarkable that statement is. For 140 years plus, Jerusalem had been in ruins. And they'd made an attempt to rebuild the temple, and eventually it got done. But those city walls stayed the same. Those gates were still burned. And the apathy had been overwhelming within the people. But he's able to motivate them, get them, challenge them to do differently than they have been doing their entire lives, and their parents' lives, and their grandparents' lives. Well, how does he do this? Well, first, he knows what he's talking about. He has examined the situation. He's seen the piles of rubble. He's had to, at one point, get off his animal and crawl through it to get to the other side. He knows the number of gates. He's counted it up. He knows how much wood it is and where that wood's going to come from. And he's not said anything until the right time, until he can gather all the people. Tell them, we need to do this. Challenge them. His idea does not come across as half-baked or the babblings of an idealist, but of a man who knows the situation. He's checked it out himself. Second thing he does, he identifies with the problem and he identifies with the people. Verse 17, "You see the trouble we're in." Sometimes it takes someone outside the situation to point out what the situation is, to draw attention to the elephant in the room. You know, the church that when Halloween, probably some teenager, as they want to do, threw a couple eggs on the front wall at the church building. And it stayed there until a visiting preacher came several years later and said, "Do you guys know you have eggs on the front of your church building?" Well, the next day, two of the deacons went and got a ladder and cleaned it up. They're in trouble. Their walls being burned and torn down. It was troublesome. They could never be the city of God that they should be in that ruined condition. But notice as he addresses it, he says, "We're in." He identifies with the people. He doesn't say, "The trouble you guys are in, you know, I'm going to go back to Susa someday, and you guys are going to be left here with this mess." No, he identifies with them. And so they know that he's part of them. He challenges them, thirdly, come, let us rebuild. He realizes it's a time for action, that faith shows the terms of action. Now, he can't undo the decades of inactivity, but he can challenge them from that moment forward to do the right thing, to move forward. And he knows there's going to be difficulties, but he says, let's us. He's part of what's going to be done, and how important it is that leaders would let the people know that they're in the trenches. That they're going to get their hands dirty too. They're going to be feeling the splinters from those city gates that are put in and blisters from carrying the rocks and stacking them up to make the walls. Fourthly, he reminds them of God's blessing. Verse 18, I told them of the hand of God that had been upon me for good. He tells them what God has already done. And sometimes our faith needs that, to hear God is acting. And God continues to act. And I think of a woman a number of years ago praying for healing for her cancer and doing it in the worship services, and you know, the doctor had given her maybe 4 to 6 months to live. And she comes to me later privately and says, do you really believe that God can heal my cancer? I said, yes, I know he can. And I recounted an incident that I knew of where, you know, the doctor had said, get your house in order, you're going to die. And 5 years later, the man was still alive. As they had prayed that he had been healed when the doctors thought there was absolutely no hope for him. An infectious faith that recounts what God has already done. We can always go to the Bible and look at those things that God has done for his people. Fifth, Nehemiah, as he has this infectious faith, sets a clear and specific goal. It's very simple. Rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Not a simple task, but it's there. This is what we're called to do. This is what I want you to do. And too often, when it comes to the goals, we become indefinite. You know, Pastor, I want to get my life in order. Okay, that's good. But what do you mean? How will we know when your life is in order? Well, maybe if I don't overdraw my bank account. That'll be an indication. Okay, well, let's work on that. Let's get your financial house in order. Let's make that your goal. Or sometimes as people think about goals, it's outlandish, you know. Well, our goal as a congregation should be to see every single person in Terre Haute converted. Well, only God converts. And we know there are those who God does not save. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, Nehemiah appeals to the best of motives. He appeals not so that the people will be in safety and security, not so they'll be able to carry on their lives and earn a good living as they're safe and in this walled city, but it's for God's glory. And so he says, that we may no longer suffer derision, and so that the city of God would no longer be seen as a disgrace and the people living it. So he's concerned for the glory of God. That Jerusalem, God's city, and we sang about it in Psalm 48. His chosen dwelling place would be a light to the nations and not a source of derision. And the third point we see here is that this bold faith in Nehemiah was also a determined faith. A faith that didn't back down, that didn't easily give up in the face of obstacles. Now, the first obstacle that Nehemiah meets is actually in terms of people. As you look at verse 10 and verses 19 and 20, first two men are mentioned, and then a third is added. These are the obstacles that he has to deal with. Sanballat. He's the leader of Samaria. And it's the nation directly north of where he is, only a few miles away. Tobiah. It's interesting, that's a Jewish name. But he's no friend of Israel. He's from Ammon, the nation that has historically been an enemy of God's people way back to the time of the wilderness when they wouldn't allow the Israelites to go through under Moses and to pass through their land. There was hostility. And so you can look in Deuteronomy 23, how they're cut off. Problem is, as you go to chapter 13, verse 4, he's related to the priest, Eliashib. He's somehow intermarried with that. But they're the enemy on the east side. And Gershom, the Arab, is the leader of a federation of Arab nations. They're to the south. And the point to see in all this is you have enemies basically in every direction. Because the west, you have the Mediterranean. But if you go to the north, you have Sanballat and the Samaritans. If you go to the east, you have Tobiah and the Ammonites, and if you go to the south, you have Gishon and the Arabs. Every which way you looked, there was opposition. And as soon as Nehemiah announced his plans, what do? Verses 19, they jeered and despised him. And then in verse 20, they questioned their motives and loyalty. Are you rebelling against the king? The most serious charge they could bring against Nehemiah. Now, they'd seen the letters from the king. They knew it wasn't true. But they questioned his motives. And I'll guarantee you, as soon as you try to do something great for God, you'll meet opposition, just as Nehemiah did. And that opposition needs to be met in the same way that Nehemiah met it with a determined faith. Notice, he doesn't argue with them. He doesn't try to justify what he's doing. He say, well, I've got these letters from the king that give me approval. His reply in verse 20 is really threefold. The God of heaven will make us prosper. We will rise and work. And you have no part in us. Jerusalem is God's city. It's for his worship. It's for his people. And these opponents are showing a different spirit, a spirit of disobedience, showing they have no part in the kingdom of God. And so he doesn't argue with them. He just answers in faith. And we need to understand that if we're serious for God, opposition won't be far off. And if you or I crumble easily, nothing will get done because it takes a determined faith. The world is filled with naysayers who mock and ridicule the church, who think what we give ourselves to is unimportant, is nonsense. And there's a devil who loves to thwart to God's people, to cast doubt and discord and distrust. And sadly, opposition often comes from even inside the church. There are people who will tell you, well, that will never work. What a dream you are to think that. We've tried that before. It seems that many Christians who otherwise are sound in their beliefs are great experts in what will not work, what is not biblical, what it will fail, and they're quick to let you know that. They have very little or no experience in what is biblical, what does work, what can be done. All they think about is what can't be done, what won't work. It's a proverb-centered spirit that really causes the person to be paralyzed, afraid to do anything. And if it gets hold of a church, the church is paralyzed and will not do anything. It takes a determined faith, an unwavering faith, to overcome such opposition. Let us have that faith. For application, realize that God has called us to a great task. Planning a church, a Reformed church where there hasn't been one, is a great task. And that's what we have before us in Terre Haute. As we desire to see a biblical church, a Reformed church, a loving church, a faithful church, a church that's filled with members who are men and women of faith, it will take a determined and realistic, infectious faith on the part of each one of us. And with that faith, let us send our hands to the good work, just as those in Nehemiah's day did. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we give thanks for this man Nehemiah that you raised up to prepare the way for your Messiah, make Jerusalem a city that would be suitable for him to come to teach and ultimately to die just outside its gates. May we show that same faith that we see in Nehemiah, that bold faith, that trust you, that faith that's realistic in situations, that is infectious and that's determined, that is not does not back down when there are naysayers around us. Help us to be those men and women of faith who rise up to the challenge, who set our hands.